You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. This is another episode in our Summer of Director season, and today we're going to explore the work of the man once described as the grizzly bear genius of American cinema, Robert Altman. Joining me to discuss all things Altman is Matt.
Hey there.
And Dan.
Hello.
We've each picked a specific Altman film we wanted to talk about, but I think before we get to that, I just thought I'd ask what our first experiences of Altman were. So, starting with Dan, how did you discover his work?
I think the first Altman film I saw was actually The Player when it got released, and I didn't really know who he was or anything about him at the time. Like, I didn't have any lead up to it. I just heard that it was good, and like, I was starting out as a film nerd, you know, and I thought I would check it out. And I can't, my take, this is a bit of a hot take, I can't even say today that I really like The Player, but it is a mysterious movie to me, and it remains that way. And it caught something that really, that I'd never seen before. And like, in a debate with my friends after going to see it, as they thought it was total trash, and I was like, okay, I agree, I hated it also, but there's something interesting in that. And I don't hate it now. I think like there's something irritating about that movie on purpose, I think. And I may have related the story on a previous Cup of Culture podcast where my favorite horror movie ever is Don't Look Now, with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. And when I first saw it, I despised it, and I complained about it for like weeks until my friends were like, dude, I think you're in love with it. It was like a girlfriend. I think you're in love with that film. And I went back and I realized that like the fact that it upset me was good. And that's what happened with The Player. I was like, this rubbed me the wrong way in a lot of ways. And it created a sensibility in me that was a good thing.
How about you, Matt? What was the first Altman you came across?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to talk about three Altmans actually to kind of make sense of all of this. Sorry about that. The very first Altman that I saw must have been MASH, the 1970 anti-war comedy. And the thing is, I saw that film when I was a kid. So I think I was probably 10 or 12. And I mean, already for linguistic reasons, because at the time my English wasn't that great. But also just because when you're 10 or 12, you don't really know what to do with MASH. Thing is that when I was growing up, we watched a lot of MASH, the TV series, and that one was much clearer. I mean, it had some of the same DNA, obviously. But where MASH, the TV series, was likable in many ways, the characters were likable, MASH, the movie, was much more... It rubbed me the wrong way, and as a 10 or 12-year-old, I had no idea what to do with that. I haven't seen it since, so I don't know what it would be like now. So that was my first notion of Altman. And then the next one was definitely also The Player, which I saw it on TV because basically before I was 20, I watched lots of films, but they were all on TV. I saw very few things at the cinema. And I'd heard and read a lot about The Play and how it skewered Hollywood. But when I saw it, probably was around 18, I found it just too glib and cynical and amoral to enjoy it again. I mean, it wants to be these things. It's not that it's not succeeding at what it wants to do, but it was just, there's something about it that is very unpleasant. And, you know, no one gets any comeuppance. Basically, the bad guys get kind of rewarded. The good guys, of which there are very, very, very few, get fired. And at the time, again, I didn't know what to do with that. The next film that I then saw, and that's the final one that I'm going to talk about in this intro, I promise, was Shortcuts. And the thing is, Shortcuts, I'd read about it a lot. I'd heard about it a lot. And then Magnolia came out, the P.T. Anderson film, which I absolutely adore. It's one of my favorite films. But I read a lot of stuff that said, Magnolia, it's basically a bit of a ripoff of Shortcuts. So if people basically were bad-mouthing my, you know, the film that I had fallen in love with, so to speak, in favor of this other film, obviously I didn't really feel that I wanted to go and see it. I did then see it a couple of years later, also after reading some of the short stories it's based on. And my problem there was, I compared it to Magnolia, and that's not quite fair because I love Magnolia, and then watching this other film that's compared to it, I watched it and I thought, yeah, well, it's no Magnolia. And I think based on those three films, I came away thinking, I don't get Altman. And I watched one or two of his other films later on, but the thing is, I think his films of the 90s and 2000s are definitely not the films that are generally considered his greatest ever. except perhaps for the player and shortcuts. So I missed out on the ones that everyone said were really, really great. What about you, Alan?
Yeah, well, I know definitely the first one I saw because I was taken by my dad to the cinema to watch Popeye when it came.
Yes.
So, and it was very weird. They showed it again here in London as the BFI, as part of, they had an Altman season, and they actually had like one screening of Popeye one Sunday afternoon. And I went to see it, and what really struck me was how much I remembered from, I think I probably was about 7 years old. And when you're 7 years old, I know I didn't feel like I was allowed to not like a film. You went to the cinema, you enjoyed it because you were in the cinema. And I don't think you had the discerning taste to go, I didn't, it just was a thing you did and you enjoyed it. And I remember enjoying it. I remember coming out. And it was amazing how much had struck. Like specific scenes that then rewatching it was just sort of a sort of Proustian rush of 7 year old me remembering that for the first time. So that was definitely the first one, and young me definitely enjoyed it. I think making it a trilogy of references, the first one I remember as an adult was The Player. Mm-hmm. And I definitely remember being disappointed because it felt like quite a cozy satire. You sort of felt how much the really great, nasty films about Hollywood are nasty. It almost seemed quite cozy. It couldn't quite let itself be as horrible as it wanted to be. And I remember being very disappointed by that. And then reading an interview about Altman a little bit later where he basically said the same thing. He sort of, they were finishing the edit. He suddenly had this moment of feeling like, I've been too nice. And I sort of feel that's true. There's nothing in it that sort of replicates that feeling, which I think you get from A Sunset Boulevard. This is someone who really likes films, but is really angry. I think it feels like someone who goes, this is an easy target. I'm going to aim and I'm bound to hit. And it sort of felt a little bit like, yeah, there's interesting stuff in it, but it just sort of was a little bit disappointing. And just to replicate in terms of three, so after that, because that was watched in the context of Altman, the genius director, and I think I was sort of teenage enough to go, well, I don't think much of your genius director if that's what he's produced. So I there was a little bit of like avoiding Altman, or I'd watch it, I think, in a mindset that was, well, I'm not impressed by you, and okay, you're not going to impress me by this. And I do think the turning point, weirdly, was Gosford Park, because I went to see that in the cinema and again came out going, this Altman, I don't know why he's so highly regarded. That just seemed like a boring film. And then a couple of years later, it appeared on telly and I had nothing else to do. I started watching it and everything clicked. Like the whole thing made sense. That I was absolutely hooked on it. And at the end, I was sort of, that is a work of genius. And it sort of made me realize that there's an element to which, like, if you're going to go in with the state of mind of, oh, you're a great director, or you will impress me, I don't think you're going to get a lot out of Altman. I think if you sort of go in and just, okay, what is my impression of this? Just not take in too much baggage and just sort of experience it. I've got more out of Altman. I still think his sort of filmography is a bit of a mixed bag, but that was definitely the turning point of like, I need to give him a chance and not swan around with this teenage attitude that everyone told me he was a genius.
Right.
So of course I'm going to rebel against that and he's not a genius. So I think that's sort of how I came to sort of Altman, and to some extent that, is he a genius, isn't he, was one of the reasons why I sort of looked at Altman as a good suggestion for the Summer of Directors. He's someone that you get a lot of opinions about, and someone that if you hear someone's opinion, positive or negative, a lot of the time I can understand where they're coming from. I can see both sides with Altman, which I think is to his credit in terms of being someone who was sort of a bit experimental. I think that was sort of the reason to sort of look into Altman and sort of picking the films we wanted to look at. We've all picked a film and I think have an aspect of that film we wanted to talk about. And the first film we wanted to talk about is The Long Goodbye. Dan, you selected this film to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of my favorite films of all time, like top five movies I've ever seen. And I think my player seeing self from when I was a kid, if he heard me say that, he'd be super mad at me right now. But I also want to throw in, I have to amend, you're absolutely correct. My first actual experience with Altman was Popeye. And I just didn't know anything about movies at the time. I saw it in the movie theater when I was like, whatever, 9. And I can still sing all the songs today. Like, I know everything backwards and forwards from that movie. It's really, really funny. So Altman, like you're saying, it's like, for me, Altman has, like, the older I get, the more I don't want to say I get Altman, but I'm more in the Altman mindset. And so I think it's more like I'm coming into phase with Altman and his point of view the older I get. And The Long Goodbye, in particular, after, you know, I've been in Los Angeles working in movies and making things and making my own stuff and having the LA experience, like, when I finally saw The Long Goodbye, I may have seen it when I was much, much younger, but I didn't re-see it until probably about, you know, less than 10 years ago. And when I saw it, like, it was a really crystalline experience. Like, just everything in the movie lined up with how I felt about what Los Angeles is. And I still think that there's nothing that really grabs it quite as completely as Long Goodbye. And I think that, like, what's interesting about this is that, unlike any of his other movies, the reason why this lines up so well is because this is about isolation, as opposed to the community experience of almost everything else he does. Like, this is about a person who is completely outside of that community. And it's like making a feature-length version of the end of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, when, you know, McCabe is separated from the town, essentially. And this is like the afterlife of that character's experience. Like, you're wandering around in this extremely pleasant but intangible place where everyone seems to be in their own universe. And it's incredibly hard to communicate with anyone meaningfully, even if your interactions are sort of pleasant, because everyone has their thing that they want to say, or their, you know, the thing they're trying to accomplish. And there's not a lot of trade back and forth. And I know that sounds like a super cynical vision of LA, but I don't really feel like, if you loop the player into that conversation, like, I disagree with the player as a and with Shortcuts as a version of LA. I have never seen that LA ever. I've never seen that LA in business. I've never seen that LA in suburbia. Like, I don't recognize it at all. And I hope that I don't come into phase with those, you know, because I really think that The Long Goodbye, as melancholy and as solitary as it is, it's not yet cynical. It's actually very heartbreaking, because it's about a guy who, you have Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe. You know, it's a classic Philip Marlowe story that they're adapting. And he has been in the business long enough that he doesn't mind that there's no one to talk to, really. He's completely settled into it. He's got his routine with his cat. He jokes with himself, running commentary a la Popeye, by the way. You know, just like constantly sort of chatting with himself.
That's a really interesting parallel that I sort of noticed on the rewatch, having seen Popeye, that his muttering to himself in this film is
key,
pure.
It's key. It's
pure
key.
Popeye.
Yeah, exactly.
You could probably sync the two next to each other and they would sound identical.
It's so true. And which is when, like, when I went back and rewatched Popeye, like, I now also love Popeye. Like, Popeye is madness, but it is a really enjoyable madness to me. And I see a lot of Long Goodbye in that. But, like, with, you know, with Marlowe, like, Elliot Gould is at the top of his game, and, like, he's always great, but he's never better than this. And he's so sort of gentle and accommodating with everyone. Like, he's not, you know, sort of getting in anybody's face about the case. He's just sort of rolling with it. Nothing is meaningful to him, and that's okay with him, until he meets Sterling Hayden. And Sterling Hayden is cut from the same cloth as Marlowe is. And what's really brilliant about this is that when they communicate, Sterling Hayden is essentially talking nonsense. Like, it's hard to even understand what he's saying, like, in a really literal way. He's just like a half crazy drunk old writer. But the mode that they're speaking in and the flavor of their hanging out is unlike anything else that happens for Elliot Gould in the movie. And he connects with this guy on such a root level that when he's gone in the film, that's when Marlowe has his heart broken. And so it's not the love story with the femme fatale. It's not any of the plot. It's not any of that. He's like, I can handle all that stuff. What I can't handle is actually connecting with someone. I can't trust that, because it's too much to lose. And I think that that is such a statement about not only about LA, but when I rewatched it for this, I was like, there's something apocalyptically depressing about this movie. And also we'll make note of this on Nashville that rings so true now in a much more global way than the limited LA sense that I saw it in before. Because like, I really feel that so many people are not trying to communicate. They're just trying to communicate themselves to someone else. And that can be enjoyable, but the distance grows more and more and more. And the investment that you have in a real shared experience starts to slip away. And with Long Goodbye, when Sterling Hayden walks into the sea, it is such a gargantuan loss that Elliot Gould, you know, he's sobbing. He's drunk and sobbing. And nobody else understands why, you know, and he's absolutely lost. And so in the end of the movie, when he kills the friend who basically is the cause of the whole scene, that is him disconnecting completely with the world. Like, he's like, fine, I will be completely alone and I'll be happy in that. And so like, this movie is, it manages to capture both the happiest and best parts of my experience in Los Angeles, and also the loneliest bits of my experience in Los Angeles. And this past go around, it seems to have yet more to say to me on a global scale that I'm almost not ready to quite process yet.
I mean, I will admit with this one, I sort of came to it being a huge fan of Marlowe. And I felt, and I read Elliot Gould's casting, and I thought, that is genius. That is someone I really want to see play Marlowe. So I sort of came in wanting this version of Marlowe. You know, this, you're looking at the 70s, I'd already seen Chinatown, which I do think is an incredible film. Sure. And I was sort of wanting that kind of film, which this is not.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very hard to engage with, because it's almost like a Marlowe adaptation by someone who doesn't really like Marlowe.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right.
And I think that's sort of, it's sort of quite interesting to, again, I think this comes back around in Altman's work, that he's doing films which are kind of in a genre that I don't think he's that interested in. I don't think he's that bothered with.
He's dismissive of, right?
Yeah, and it sort of lacks, to use sort of about what I would say about Sunset Boulevard, it lacks that you need to both love and be angry about something.
Ah, yeah.
And then you make the best savage attack on it, or you make the best love letter, and ideally the two come at the same time.
Right.
And so there was a huge level of disengagement in terms of getting to the stage of, you know, properly sitting there going, Marlowe wouldn't do that.
Right.
You stop getting Marlowe wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you're not making the film I wanted, which was coming from what the expectations were with the film. And I think when you were sort of mentioning the sort of LA nature of the story, and I don't know LA at all, but rewatching it again, I've seen more of movie LA,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen more of films that I think imitate the structure. So something like Under the Silver Lake, something that has the idea of we're going to follow characters wandering in this world. I mean, I'd even put something, you know, even films, you'd almost put something like Brick in there.
Or Inherent Vice, like, isn't there as well. Yeah,
even Mulholland Drive a little bit. This was like slightly aimless wandering mm-hmm. in this world of LA. And I think watching it again for this, it made more sense as that kind of film. Mm-hmm. I started seeing it as, you know, this is sort of, we're dropped into this character. And if I don't bring all my baggage from liking Marlowe and loving the books and everything I get out of Chandler, if I sort of put that to one side, I got a lot more out of it. But I think I've said this to Matt before. I first saw it, and when he shoots the guy at the end, mm-hmm. I almost got up in the cinema to say no.
Yes.
You know, it's leaving the cinema pretty close to fury.
Yeah.
And I was rewatching it, and I was thinking, would that recreate that emotion? Would I get to the end and just have that moment of... And actually, I didn't this time at all. I got to the end and it made sense given the sort of film I'd been seeing.
It's starting to get you. I've introduced this movie to a lot of people, and I think there's a consistent development of their opinion of the movie. I would say, if I were to sum it up, it is, I think it's brilliant what you said about like how you relate to Chandler versus how you do not relate to Elliot Gould's Chandler, Marlowe, is the, with Chandler, as surface level cynical as Chandler is, he's not actually cynical. The reason why he's cynical is because there's something he believes in that's not being satisfied, right? he was living in constant proof of disappointment. But if he really thought the world was a bad place, then he'd stop worrying about it, right? And so this is the strange disguise of this movie, is it's very light and very breezy looking and beautifully shot by Vilmos Zsigmond. And what it's describing is absolute disassociation. And I think that's what you just landed on for me. I was like, you're not connecting in the same way that he is not connecting. Mm. And I think that once you capture that, like, the more you're going to identify with the fact that he becomes my avatar of disconnection. And it's really, really it's a totally profound experience now. It's very strange. Mm.
And I think if I'd gone into the film and it didn't have this title and the lead character was called Marlon or something.
Yeah, sure.
And they've just done a little bit to change it. Right. And then I've got, okay, I'm not going to come with this baggage. So, Matt, what did you feel about this?
I mean, it's interesting, the stuff that you've now said, I think, kind of points out two things for me. One thing is that I've found with Altman, even with the films that we're discussing now, pretty much all of them, I have to watch them twice to understand what I feel about them. And that might still change after a while. But for instance, I've seen The Long Goodbye and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which we're going to talk about later on, twice. I've only seen Nashville once. And I realize that will basically very much limit me in what I can say about it, because I feel I haven't quite arrived at what the film is, what it's trying to do, and therefore I can't even relate to it. I think with The Long Goodbye, that the first time I saw it, I found it fascinating, but I couldn't really say what I was supposed to, I don't know. I just didn't know what the film was doing. I'm not sure yet now whether I know what it's doing, although after what the two of you have said, I think I have to go and see it a third time. It has this weird thing where it is actually quite easygoing in a very ambling Elliot Gould way. You know, it starts with the kind of low-key irony that Gould's character has, the stuff with the cat, the frequently naked neighbors, the music especially. It's got this kind of ambling postmodernism that is actually very, very amiable. But mm-hmm. I think the more the films keep scratching at the veneer, there's something underneath it which is perhaps more sour, more mm-hmm. cynical. I don't think it's a film that's sour, but it's the world that it depicts. You know, what you just said, Dan, about, you know, everyone is kind of nice, but it's in a very, I'm going to be a bit, you know, kind of the typical European having, you know, snide opinions about the US, you know, this it has this very have a nice day thing.
Yes.
You know, where
yes.
everything is kind of friendly and happy, mm-hmm. but it's also phony, self-serving, cynical, airheaded, or any combination of these things. You can't trust what you see, because at first you're going to get the have a nice day thing. And I think it's how you get these sudden tonal breaks, the sudden violence, like Marty Augustine cutting his girlfriend's mm-hmm. face, or the mm-hmm. murder at the end that you've already alluded to. The bits where it gets kind of real versus the Shaggy Dog story, this ambling quality, that I still don't quite know what to do with it, but I find it very fascinating. I think in some ways, I can totally see if you're very much into the kind of classic 50s film noir type of thing, and you expect, you know, Chinatown, I think, is much more classical in that respect. Of course, it's an updating, but it still does that kind of thing. And this, I think, does something that's much more 70s, for want of a better mm-hmm. word. And that's something that I find, yeah, that's one of the reasons why I need to watch it twice. But another thing, sorry, kind of taking the long way to get to this, is I realize, again, as a European, and now I'm kind of putting myself down a bit, so much of America we just know from the movies. LA especially, mm-hmm. we just know movie LA. We know different takes on movie LA. I think I was once on the outskirts of LA at night. I was half asleep. Perhaps that's the best way to have the first experience. But that was just, you know, a half hour thing. Other than that, the LA I know is the LA that is on the movie screen. Mm-hmm. And probably that's something that I find difficult to relate to. This, you know, the real LA or the one of the real LAs. That's just something I have no experience of. I just compare this to movie LAs. And that makes it a bit, I don't know. I think that means my take on the film is always going to be limited by that.
I think what you bring up about the violence in the center of the movie with Marty Augustine is really where I want to pick on that just to note it for a second, because you're absolutely right. Like, it's so shocking that it's the thing that cuts the surface so you see what is beneath, right? And I think that that's a hard scene for me to watch, like, now. Like, that's one of these scenes. There are a number of scenes in Altman movies where I just go, like, I think I might just have to fast forward through this. And that's one of them. There's another one we'll bring up in Nashville, but that's the truth of it. It's like when you say that, like, you know, like LA is, you know, you only see in LA you know, in terms of the movies. Right? L.A. has only ever seen L.A. in terms of the movies. Like, the idea of the real L.A. experience is extremely, what's the word? Like, effluvial? Is that the right word? I'm not sure. The, like, it's something that you don't notice until it's already left the room. Doesn't mean it's not beautiful. It can be beautiful. There are moments I have, I'm like, I love Los Angeles. It's really wonderful. I love it more the longer I live here. But the longer I live here, the less I have to prove. And much of what Los Angeles is people trying to prove themselves and the masks they put up to do that. And when you see beneath the mask of, say, a character like Marty Augustine, for all of his sort of like, you know, well-worded explanation of why he's doing what he's doing, he's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's simply a monster, and that's it. There's no talk that can get around that. And that's the kind of thing, like, Elliot Gould is, like, he sees this, and he sees the truth of Sterling Hayden. The truth of Marty Augustine and the truth of Sterling Hayden. And one is titanically evil, and the other is titanically good, and the good one goes away. And that ache that that represents is very much what I feel about at least half of my time in Los Angeles. That's very, it's so very accurate. It's, and it's so hard to grab. I've never seen any other movie that does it like that. So I think even if you've never really spent time here, you've spent a little bit of time in LA with Elliot Gould.
I mean, that sort of point about the dissociation and the titanically good and titanically bad, I found really interesting, because one of the things I tried to do watching it this time is, this is the first time I've watched it after reading the theory about a lot of the origins of noir detectives.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is very much the noir detectives are basically writers in Hollywood. That there are people who had these grand ambitions to be great masters of literature, and they came to Hollywood to work, and they sold out their soul, and they were on their own writing and getting by and having to deal with whole sort of eccentrics. And that from this, you get the sort of noir hero.
Yes.
Ever, no private detective was ever like,
well, this is literally Sunset Boulevard. Like, that is a screenwriter.
It's,
that's the best part.
It is purely, these are screenwriters living a bit of a fantasy as detectives, but it's basically the world that they're in. And they want to be better than they are, but in the end of the day, you know, they'll get a job to write another crappy film or an advert, and they'll take it up because they need the money. And suddenly watching this film, thinking, well, as Altman as the writer, if this is Altman, what is he trying to tell us? What is his view of working in Hollywood that Elliot Gould is showing us? And I think it's sort of interesting if we're looking at it, you know, being disassociated, being thinking that there is something great here, there's something titanically great, but there is also something truly awful. I think there is a lot, I think, of mileage maybe in that, in looking at it and thinking he's repurposed what Hammer and Chandler were doing with their sort of pulp detectives. He's repurposed that for a director in Hollywood.
Yes.
And I think that's what makes it an interesting an interesting angle too, that which I got a lot out of watching it this time.
Brilliantly put. I have to say that. I'm going to rip you off forever right there. I think it was so well said. I know that Matt has heard me. We talked about Soderbergh on the other episode. Like, I do it with every filmmaker I love, is I wonder about, what is this movie? What does this movie mean through the lens of being a filmmaker? Like, what? How do the characters on screen represent being a filmmaker? And with people like, say, Soderbergh, it's incredibly direct all the time. You know, just like, you know, there's a reason why he tells, it's like, you know, when we were talking about like Che Part 1 and 2, like, Soderbergh is fascinated with how much, like, how many guys do we need to carry the bullets up the hill? Because Soderbergh is fascinated by how many data cards do we need to support the red and will it overheat in the jungle? Like, he's basically making a documentary about the making of what he's filming. And with Altman, I think you're absolutely correct that it's like, this is what Altman's films are about. Altman's films are about Altman's experience in Hollywood. Every single one of them. And like, I think it more directly than almost any other director. Like, he finds like the simplest analog to say, this is my experience, and these are the fools that I have to suffer, and these are the few good people that I can enjoy, and it's all slipping away. And he hits it over and over again.
I mean, it's actually one thing that I was thinking while I was rewatching it, and while I was also thinking about my rewatching of it, was that to some extent, I think there might be a nastier Hollywood satire in The Long Goodbye than there is in The Player, which
agreed.
I do think it is quite glib and, you know, cynical, The Player, but it's also a bit surface level.
Yes.
It goes for the easy targets. And I think in this one, I mean, you start and you end with this hooray for Hollywood, which becomes very, very sour by the end of it. And I do think there's definitely something there that is not as obvious as it is with The Player, but I think that also means that it is perhaps one that's there's more there, you know, to find on rewatching it and rewatching it.
Definitely. And I think in relation to sort of experiencing the films of Altman, I think that might take us nicely on to Matt, your selection is you selected McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which I think came out, I think The Guardian did a top 20 of Altman's films. This was at number one. This was critically lauded as his best. Did you find that, or how did you feel about the film?
Again, I mean, as I said before, I think I'm at a point where I think I have to watch Altman's films twice to get to a point where I feel I've seen them once. And the first time I saw this one, I remember liking it, but it didn't stay with me. It's somehow I couldn't connect to, I don't know, my own reaction on the film. And the second time I saw it, I realized, actually, I think I kind of love this film. I think I found myself attuned to its vibe only the second time I watched it. This melancholy thing, this anti-heroic thing, this rejection of the iconic that's in the Western or the idealized that's in so many Westerns. I mean, so many Westerns, even some of the neo-Westerns of the 60s, are still very much, you know, when men were real men and women were real women. You do have, even in some of the, you know, the Westerns of the 60s, you've got this machismo and sentimentalism that sometimes comes with this one song of, you know, the last days of the old West. And this one doesn't have that. I don't think it has the, it definitely doesn't have the machismo. I think it's got sentiment, but I don't think it's sentimental. It's melancholy, sad, even if there's a fairly persistent irony in which kind of the sadness is, or the irony is drenched in a sadness that's there from the beginning and that only gets stronger. It's one of those films where I think it could only have been made in the 70s because of its tone, because of its texture. There's something quintessentially 70s about it, although don't ask me exactly what I mean by that, but it's just something that I've found in a lot of these 70s films that, in a way, tone and texture are perhaps more important even than plot, than characters. Mm-hmm. Although characters are important, but it's really the texture of this, the feel of this, that is very central to, I think, the experience of the film. I mean, you do get parallels in terms of theme and form in, for instance, HBO's Deadwood, the David Milch series, which is also anti-Western and about the making of America. And just like, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I think Deadwood is also a Western that's not a foundation myth, but more a, you know, what was it really like? The kind of little guy that's ground under by the interests of big capital, which is, of course, a very modern concern. Mm-hmm. But again, the texture is different, and I think it's the music by Leonard Cohen, especially the songs that are essential to the texture of this film. And the shootout in the snow, which is beautiful, but it's the opposite of badass, which you might get in other Westerns. Mm-hmm. And again, something like Deadwood, I think, which compares in many ways, is not immune to badassery every now and then. There's also this painterly look that made me think very much of Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. And I think Kubrick actually talked to Altman about the camera work in this one. I love with this one the casting, which goes against the grain, especially with Warren Beatty. I mean, Warren Beatty is such a, he's basically an amazingly beautiful star. He should be heroic. But in this film, he's somehow someone who's coasting on his charm, on his good looks. And he's getting to a point where this just isn't enough anymore. McCabe is a bit of a loser. He's a, even a bit of a facade. You know, when he comes into this little town, everyone thinks, ah, oh, he's that pudgy McCabe guy, a gunslinger. He killed so-and-so. But there's serious doubt that he ever killed anyone. And I mean, look at Warren Beatty. Who would ever call him pudgy? I mean, seriously. And Mrs. Miller is miles smarter. She's miles ahead of him. She can run circles around him. She's much more business savvy. But she also has built a wall around herself, and she only allows herself vulnerability when she's on opium. You've got these very interesting characters who could be archetypes, but they actually kind of skew or completely turn around the archetypes. So he's not the hero. She's not the hooker with a heart of gold. He is a silly idealist in some respects, but he is silly in his idealism, and it's kind of admirable. But it's also obvious this guy is doomed. He can't hack it. And she's a realist, but she is also somehow, she's probably also too realist for this world. Mm-hmm. And I love this kind of sad romanticism, which, as I said, I don't think it ever gets sentimental. Yeah, I think I've fallen in love with this film and I want to see it again for its texture, for its feel, and for, you know, these two people who, one of them is better prepared for this world that they're in than the other, but neither of them really stands much of a chance in the long run. What about you, Alan?
I mean, my sort of feeling with this, and this is a sort of recurrent theme with Altman, is again, beware the baggage you take into films. Because the first time I saw this, it was like, this is a revisionist Western, and, you know, you're going to have all your understanding of the Western going to be challenged by this person who broke the mold. And again, I mean, partly because we're now so many decades later and nobody makes Western. The revisionist Western has become the Western. The anti-Western is the Western now. So.
Yes, exactly.
So the you sort of watch this going, well, actually, I've seen a more cynical film than this. I've seen sort of darker takes on the Western than this. I've seen, this sort of feels quite mild in that sort of backdrop. And so again, on the first viewing, that was, again, walking out going like, ah, oh, Mr. Genius Director, you failed again or you've been superseded again.
I've beat you.
And then on the rewatch, what I sort of really, really enjoyed, and I think one of the things, agreeing with Matt in terms of multiple viewings, but I think I come from the fact that I need the first watch to get over my baggage. And I think if you come in and you go, okay, this is, don't expect this to sort of challenge what you understand a Western to be, just look at it as a story. And I found it quite, it almost feels like a very clever love letter to Leone.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of the machismo of Clint Eastwood, they've basically put Sam Malone from Cheers as the lead.
That's hysterical.
You've got this sort of womanizing idiot, right, whose ambition is beyond what he could do,
right,
and it ultimately undoes him. And this sort of, it does feel to me like a very much a Leone film. But instead of the films that try to do Leone and just end up as sort of, you know, they feel like a carbon copy, it's got a lot of the essence that I really like about Leone. It's got moments that feel illustrating how there was this storybook good and evil in the West. I think there's the scene on the bridge,
mm-hmm,
where the sort of more sort of innocent cowboy gets shot. It's pure Leone.
Mm-hmm.
They make him go for his gun so they can shoot it. That feels like the sort of cynical, horrible world of Leone. And it's got some great Leone faces.
Yep.
The way that you're in this world of incredible faces. And also, like, the dialogue often is a little bit like they're sort of giving a bit more of what they see as being the truth. They give a bit more Leone dialogue about, here's where we are, here's what this is about, in a cynical way, rather than necessarily how they talk. Like, the villains will make a good point about how villainous they are, and you don't do that if you're a good villain. But it sets it in the snow. It then says, well, we're not going to live in the sort of Spanish desert. And then it has this genuine couple in the middle that Leone, I don't think, ever did properly in any of his Westerns. That by making these characters more of a loser, they're more interesting. And it sort of felt like, you know, a sweet, cynical Leone film,
mm-hmm,
building on what he did, but doing something new and something really interesting. And watching it as that, again, I suddenly thought, no, this is, I enjoy this film for that. And it was a real sort of, again, the second viewing sort of made the difference. Because that notion that I don't think he goes to the Western, I don't think he loves and is angry about the Western, so you're not going to get that sort of satire, you're not going to get that revision of it. I think he's just more interested in this story of the characters, and he will tell it in his own pace, and it will look gorgeous. And it sort of works on that level as a film. But what about you, Dan? What do you take it?
Well, I loved what you guys are saying, but you know, when you talk about revisionist Westerns and versus, you know, I'm an American, so obviously I love badass Clint Eastwood movies. Like, that's built into my DNA. And I love every kind of Western there is. This is one of the very tops on my list, like, and one of my favorite films, like in probably the top 25 range. I think it's probably a much better film than Long Goodbye. Long Goodbye speaks so specifically to me that it's, the connection's unavoidable. But when you're talking about, like, what this is in relation to other Westerns, that's the most revealing aspect of it. It's like if you take out the elements that are Leone, and you take out the elements that are Eastwoody, and you take out the elements that are old school mythos, you know, and all that, what makes the movie work is that it's this very gentle, spiritual movie and like nature spiritual, not like Christian spiritual, but spiritual movie about humans in the world. And everything else is a story. Like everything else is a put on. And so you see the movie, like you see the town get built up from nearly nothing in the middle of a wilderness to a functional town over the course of the movie, just like in Deadwood. And so when you brought up Deadwood, I was like, what is the difference between these things? They feel like very different experiences to me. And I love Deadwood. Deadwood's incredible. I've seen the show. I've watched the show all the way through like three times, four times. But Deadwood is a very intellectual experience. Like it's thinking about these mechanisms, how capitalism works, how that interacts with the players in the town, and how that affects the growth of the town and how it affects individuals. And it's sort of like it says the law of Deadwood is that what we are talking about, the intellectualization of our interaction via capitalism, is real, and that is the subject, right? And in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, it's a put on. Like it's all a fantasy. Like we're looking for ways to connect with one another and live together and enjoy each other. And the natural organization that comes out of that lends itself to storytelling. And once the stories are involved, it starts to mess things up. Like I think there's a very big, you bring up the shootout with Carradine and the evil kid on the bridge. Carradine is, you know, he's dressed like a Tom Mix cowboy, right? Like he's just like innocent as they come, but he's not like innocent like I'm watching the innocent character in a John Wayne movie. He's innocent like he's some random kid from LA, you know. He's just some dude. Like he's nice. He's just one. He was looking to go hook up with some ladies and, you know, have a good time and hang out with some guys, and that's it. Like it's beautiful country out here. And he is up against this sort of organized force that's pressing a story onto him, and he's destroyed by it. And that's just a microcosm. That's a small version of what happens to McCabe. McCabe has this idea for himself as like, you know, and I'll build this business and it'll get larger and larger. I'll get more organized. And he does this and it's successful, mainly because he meets Mrs. Miller, who's actually good at it, you know. But in the end, he's undone by what that attracts when he misses out on the community that is happening, which is a human event that has nothing to do with money or laws or corporations or anything. It's a bunch of women in bathing tubs joking and hanging out. It's a bunch of people saving their burning church. That has nothing to do with law. That has to do with people. And I think that that weird, incredible gentleness is something you just don't see in literally any other Western at all. Every other Western I can think of, and I love Westerns soup to nuts, is about, with Deadwood, it's about savvy, intellectual cleverness and ethics, right? With Eastwood, it's about morals and vengeance. You know, like they're all, it gets high-minded, like it gets intellectual no matter what you're doing. And with Leone, I'd argue it's just with aesthetics. Like he's like, I'm going to organize this visually and musically so you have a emotional experience just from looking at a thing, right? But this movie feels like I am privy to a human experience that I want to be a part of and I rarely get. And just like Long Goodbye, I miss out, you know? And I think that there's, with this in mind, now when we were describing these movies, there's a weird emotional progression with Altman that essentially, if you put these movies in the correct order from MASH to The Player and you watch them straight through, you'd want to die. Like you'd actively want to die, because these movies are stages of giving up on the world. And The Player is the worst because there's no humanity in it at all. Like it's inert. It's completely morally inert. It's emotionally inert. It's spiritually inert. He's given up and it's just technique. And the absence of any care or love for anyone is why that movie pissed me off. Whereas you see the joy of MASH, the melancholy of Long Goodbye, this aching need in Mrs. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Like you see this dude's journey through the course of his artistic life, and he's doing it very straightforwardly as opposed to stylistically, even within the ways of, like, I love P.T. Anderson, but he's a very sort of style forward filmmaker. And whereas Altman is more than happy to let it run. And I think that there's something that nobody has quite nailed since the 70s, when you bring up the 70s, is specifically in Altman's work, in anything else I've ever seen.
By the way, what you said about, you know, the film being very gentle and spiritual, I don't know whether either of you have seen Kelly Reichardt's First Cow. And I have to say that to some extent, the just the feel, again, the texture perhaps of
Great.
First Cow and McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah.
In a way, the distance that this film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, is from the classical Western, if you go in that direction even further, you arrive at First Cow, where, you know, it's not even, you know, hookers and a broth, which is kind of the archetypical, you know, business in a Western town. There it's about baking cakes.
Yeah, it's making some good sweets.
Exactly. But I think the gentleness, this need for connection, is very much there in both of them. And the melancholy that is also, it's a certain kind of melancholy that I don't think you find in many Westerns, but I think both of them have it. And I mean, both of them also have René Auberjonois, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah,
so there's even a link there with the actors.
That's wonderful. That's a really wonderful point about, I'm a tremendous Reichardt fan, and she's another sort of like non-judgmental filmmaker. She lets the characters in the stuff judge each other all the time, but she just sort of is there to accept the experience. And you look at First Cow, Old Joy, Wendy and Lucy, which I could watch a million times. Like, you're right. I take it back. There is one filmmaker that reminds me of Altman, and that's it's definitely her. That's a great point.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll move now on to the third film the Tuttle brought to the table, and that was my choice of film, which was Nashville. I picked this because this is the one that, even with baggage, even coming in, I remember watching and halfway through unashamedly thinking this is a great film. that there is a quality to this that is, you sort of admire it. You just sort of think, I've not seen anyone do this, but I'm also enjoying it. I'm also engaged with this. I'm also interested in it. And all of that mixed together is, oh, this is a great film. And to have that sort of moment in there was, and I think this is still one of my favorite Altman films. And I think one of the things I really like about it, which I think is a plus in quite a few of his films, is the ensemble. Is the way it handles the multiple characters in a way that you're being told a story, you don't know where any of these character stories will definitely go, but you feel you know them. And that's a sort of weird combination. Normally you think you know the character and you maybe, there'll be a misstep. It'll say, you didn't know them at all, here's plot twist. Or you kind of know, oh, that character's quite naive. They're going to end up destroyed by their naivety. And in this, you've got this sort of strange, interesting mix of characters that are all, you get an angle of them very quickly, and then the film isn't interested in telling you a story about that. It's just interested in, like, showing you these characters in this sort of interesting world that it gives the time to make the likable characters seem unlikable, and the unlikable characters have their moment that you think, they're quite nice, they're quite thoughtful, but in the end it's this sort of cynical show business world. That I think, again, we sort of mentioned about how The Long Goodbye feels more successfully satirical than The Player. I think this is as well. The level of improvisation, I think, from a lot of the people on this, who are all sort of actors, who all have this experience of showbiz, and they're bringing their what they dislike about showbiz, what they've learned, what they have discovered is terrible about this world, they're bringing it to this film. And I think it's testament to Altman that they're writing songs for this film. He got the people involved to really sort of commit to putting so much of themselves in this film. And it's all there when you watch it. You have this sort of, it is one of the best improvised communal films that I think feel like you've got a lot of talent here, because it's not overly indulgent. It doesn't feel like you're hanging out with these Hollywood people and they're having a bit of a fun time and we'll deign to be lucky enough to let you watch us have fun. Doesn't feel like that. It does feel like they have a purpose to this film. There's an element of anger to this film, and they're being incredibly creative. Like, the songs in it feel like very credible country tunes, while also perfectly satirical.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you put up with this. You know, this is a society that there's a song about, I've been cheating on my wife with you, but it's not going to work because I'm a family.
So good.
And that's sort of like a genius angle to come at. It's just sort of like, and
so good.
That they brought these songs that they wrote for the film, and they all mix this, sometimes this homespun quality, this mix this cynical attitude to, like, you accept this. You we live in a world where this is seen as okay. It's not okay. This is weird. This is like, how we're treating people, how we live with ourselves is often portrayed in these songs, which I think is incredible. An insight into the characters. If you're seeing a character who's not very nice, you get this insight often through the music of how they do live with themselves, how they don't see themselves as the villain of the story, even though they're a horrible, arrogant, vain person. And all of this, I think, comes from Altman facilitating an ensemble production and really knowing when to let people act as act and to give them the freedom to really come in and bring what they've learned about show business and what they're angry about that show business and bring it into a film. And I think that's, I see that as genius. I can't think of another word for that, which, this is the film where first viewing, it made that connection and thinking, this is a great film from someone who knows what he's doing. How do you feel about it, Dan?
I completely agree with you. How can I say this? I dread watching Nashville more and more every time I see Nashville. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant in every way. It's more and more profoundly accurate with every year. Every time I see it, I'm like, yep, he nailed it. He absolutely, him and his crew could not have captured more perfectly this slow disaster. And I was, before I rewatched it for the show, I was gritting my teeth a little bit. I was just like, I just got to do it. I just got to do this because I want to be on point about it. Don't be that bad. It was so much worse. It was so much harder this time. I was like, I don't know if I can finish this movie. I know where it's going. It's making me crushingly sad. In particular, the scene that I find extraordinarily difficult to watch every single time is when Alan Garfield's wife, the singer, who's recovering the whole time, the one who ends up getting shot in the end of the movie, when she tries to come back too early and starts telling rambling stories on stage, it's so heartbreaking and strange to me every time that I don't even know where to put my emotions when I'm watching it. Like, I start like looking around and like get up out of the room, maybe get some coffee. Like, it's just, it's too much. And I feel like this time around it became the most clarified for me. It's like, that's the point of the spear of the movie to me, is that everybody in this movie has these deep hopes for what their experience will be in life, and they are almost all of them wasting their lives to try to experience that. And even when they're in the moment when they could experience it, they're so lost in themselves that they can't. Everyone in the movie is not just in their own plot line, they're in their own bubble. Like, everybody's in their own little story, to the point where you think that something's going to come of like the Ned Beatty, Lily Tomlin story, and it doesn't. She's had this entire other experience with someone else who also doesn't care about her. And it didn't matter. Like, it didn't matter at all. You have, like, when you point out, like, these arrogant idiots that don't even realize the things that, like, when the song you pointed out with For the Sake of the Children. I'm just like, can you hear what you're saying? Like, you sat down and write the most self-serving song of all time. Like, the most sort of performative, presentational, I am a good person song. And I were to mock you, I would write this song. Mm. It's pure, raw embarrassment. And the dude's so disconnected from the people that serve his ego that he doesn't even know that it's just a car crash on stage to watch him sing this. And that the audience is, every time they show the audience, they're not like, yeah, they're sort of like a little distracted. You know, people are walking around and you're just like, there's nobody here is here for anyone else at all. The only people that are truly engaged in life are the obviously real people that he's filming in Nashville.
Mm.
These are like documentary shots of actual people and kids singing and all that stuff. Like, they're living their life and it's real, but everyone else is on their own train. And so while watching it this time, I was like, it was just like, maybe it's because I've been because of podcasting and because of everything else that I'm doing, I've had to experience more and more social media. But I'm just like, I would say that this is the most important movie that people should see right now. But I like, we've already had enough depression from COVID. We don't need people to go through more. And so I was very happy to revisit it in terms of like, I felt like I was on hot wings and I was going for the spiciest chicken. But it's something that I'm probably going to wait another 2 or 3 years before I take a bite out of it again, because it's that good. And it's also like, I feel like it's, how can I say it? Like the beginning of the conversation, I said like that I came into phase with Long Goodbye, and I fear coming into phase with like Shortcuts or The Player. Like, I never, ever want to be there. And Nashville is saying, you're right on track, my man.
But Matt, how did you feel about the film?
And as I've said, I've only seen it once so far, for the first time, just about a week ago. I liked it, but I think I would have to see it a second time. And I think I need to let it settle for a bit before I can watch it a second time. I mean, what I have to say is, I think it's very much a 70s film. It's very much an Altman film in terms of almost the cliches of Altman, the community, the improvisational quality, the rambling quality. But I think it's also the one of these three films that speaks to 2022 most immediately. I think I absolutely agree with that. I also think that, you know, it feels very much like a predecessor to The Player, with its specific satire skewering a culture and an industry, but it feels so much darker and richer than The Player ever does. Mm-hmm. This will sound like a weird kind of tangent, but at the beginning of the year, our favorite cinema did a series of what they called paranoia movies, and they showed The Parallax Effect, which I think, you know, to some extent, there's a link there with the 70s thing and the, you know, assassinations of politicians
and the Warren Beattiness of it. Yes.
Exactly. But the thing is, where The Parallax Effect basically ends with, you know, and then this guy gets killed and it's all a conspiracy and you can't trust anyone. I think Nashville goes one step further and shows how does a culture react to all of this, and how do they react by basically forgetting about it almost immediately and singing.
Almost immediately.
You know, it's basically, let's switch to the next channel. Oh, what's there? Comedy, a musical. Yes. Great. No matter what just happened 5 seconds ago. And I think that's in a way the scariest thing. Not that there's this madman who, for whatever reason, shoots a woman who deserves better, but that, five minutes later, it's like it never happened. Who cares? It's all right with me.
Yeah, I have to interject to say that there's nothing more that can be said about that movie than what you just said. Like, that is the exact pain that I feel in watching that film. Thank you for putting it that way, because like, that is the, like what I said before, it's apocalyptic. Like, I'm like, that's the end of everything. That's it.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine it being worse than this. And everyone's singing.
Yeah, totally. At the same time, I mean, as I said, I think I would have to watch it a second time, and I'm scared of that. So if I step back and just intellectually, I think this is very much what I imagined an Altman film to be like when I heard about Altman, when I read about him. There's this German word, which sadly enough, there's no English equivalent. It's called the Wimmelbild. And it's basically, the best way to explain that in English is, there's this Where's Waldo quality to the film that I think is very much like my cliched idea of what an Altman film is like. There's always these big casts. There's not necessarily a linear story. It's just you kind of check in with, okay, next image, but there again are the couple of nuns in the corner, there's, you know, the kid eating an ice cream and the dog looking up at the ice cream. So basically you keep seeing these characters again in different contexts, and all of that is kind of describing a society by accumulation, which I really like. I mentioned Deadwood in comparison with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and I think this one, if anything, reminds me of David Simon's work in Tremé, except in Tremé, I think you have a journalistic eye, and I don't think that Robert Altman is a journalist at heart. He is very much a big textured tableaus, and I think that's very much what we get here. It's also a film where I find that, you know, with all three films, I ask myself, does Altman feel any affection for the world he depicts? Does he feel any affection for the characters he depicts? Or does he set in judgment on them? And I think there's definitely the judgment on America of the day, but there's still an affection also there. And I think that tension is something I find very interesting, but it's something that, again, requires a second viewing to see how I feel about that tension. He does criticize it, and he does skewer it, and it's quite, you know, he pinpoints exactly where he has to skewer it. But at the same time, he doesn't look down on them. It's apparently the country scene at the time felt that Altman was being arrogant about them. I don't think that's there. He is making fun of them, absolutely is satirizing them. But there is still, he sees an appeal in this world. And I think it's exactly that, seeing that appeal and seeing where it is actually quite toxic, that both kind of are there at the same time. That's key to the film to me.
I think that's sort of interesting in terms of maybe why this film resonates the most with me. As I've sort of talked before about the other films, that what it feels it lacks to me is Altman is coming to a genre that he doesn't love and he isn't angry about at the same time. And maybe it's when he comes to look at America in this film, it is something that he's very angry about and that he loves at the same time. And then that informs a lot of the emotional content of this film that I can connect to. And another thing that really sort of struck me just, and this is sort of watching a lot of, if you sort of binge Altman, is you get the feeling that in his sort of 70s heyday, he sometimes doesn't quite know how to end stuff. So I think there's an element that either the ending came first, or the element is like, the ending is like, we've been improvising, enough improvising, we need to end the film. What's the best way to do that? Somebody's going to get shot. Right. And there's an element of arbitrariness. And weirdly, it made me think, watching it, that the sort of comparison with P.T. Anderson and his sort of Altman-ness is, so with P.T. Anderson, there's the same sense of creativity, but when he gets to the end, he's positive. I think he wants a more happier ending to his world. His characters will have, their ending will be making a connection. Their ending will be something positive. Their ending will be, you know, a declaration of love or something. That's how he wants to end this kind of story. And I think Altman has no desire to do that at all. And to some extent he goes, well, I'm not quite sure how, if I'm not going to give him a happy ending, well, let's just shoot someone. And I think when you watch a sort of, in the review, you start, I think, to feel a bit more sympathetic to that as an ending, because how else is he going to end it unless you literally just sort of fade out? I think that sort of it's sort of interesting. And then you have this thing of like, you've done this sort of sprawling work, this really interesting work. There's lots of ideas in it, but almost it's a feature of the way you've created it is you're not going to come up with a nicely plotted ending that nicely encapsulates everything you've covered and caps this experience. That's not ever going to come easily from how you've made this film, but you do have to end the film. And I think this quality of sort of like, well, I'll shoot someone, it's, you know, it'll give us a bang at the end and then we're out of here. And I think I am sort of a little bit cynical about that, but I also sort of admire it because I can't see how else he would do it. And again, in terms of the baggage of coming to people who say, Altman's great, is I can remember, especially with this film, that having really enjoyed it, coming out and really enjoying it, then reading people who have insanely complicated theories about why the shooting at the end had to be there. And I'm sort of reading it and I'm going, I don't really buy it. I'm not into where you're coming from. I don't think, but I still enjoy the film. Like, you don't need to do the extra mile to come up with this, you know, this shooting is actually a reflection of the shooting of JFK and it goes back. You know, you don't need to make this really hugely elaborate thematic closure that Altman's going for. I think this is ending a film like this. You just have to bang end, because it isn't the type of film that will lend itself to a Hollywood film ending.
Right. I guess I agree. Only I think of all that as positive. Because like it is entirely random, right? It's a, like, you don't know the mind of the guy who does it at all. Like, you see him, but you don't know why he's mad, or he doesn't even seem to know why he does what he does. Like, he's, you know, moments before he chooses to do that, he's like kind of running after to try to, I forgot which character he's running after, but he's sort of like, he's showing some empathy towards someone else. And then he just gets so overwhelmed that he ends up shooting the singer. And I'm just like, the utter randomness of it connects to me in the way that in my country now we have such extreme polarization that we're starting to see real acts of violence that are motivated by people's internal monologues, essentially, about what their beliefs are and how the when you say people are going out of their way to explain there's some conspiracy theory in the movie that sort of connects it all and then gives us a reason for why this guy is doing that. Like, people do that in real life. That's how crazy assassins work. Like, they start seeing this import in everything that happens, and the more isolated they become, the more that fuels their idea of their being propelled in a story of their own in which they're the messiah, right? And they can't imagine the world works any other way until they come to a point, and this is their star moment to act. And that is an echo of what everyone in the movie is trying to do. Like, it's the violent version of being a star. Like, you have a story that you want to project onto the world about yourself, and you think it's grandly meaningful, but who the hell are you? Like, everybody else is in some other place. Like, they're incidentally interested in what you're doing. Like, there's a great, it's like the David Foster Wallace line. Like, you'd worry a lot less about what people think of you if you realized how little they did, you know? And everyone in the movie is in that spot. He's just the most extreme version of that. And I think what Matt, you're saying is like the most profoundly upsetting thing about that is that this dude is trying to make the movie about himself. He's like, I have an ending for the movie. I'll shoot the so-and-so. Right. And then the movie is momentarily distracted by that. Mm-hmm. And then it goes back to what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's weirdly something positive and community-ish about that in terms of how we shouldn't believe these stories. You know, we should believe just in our communal experience. But at the same time, the reason why it's happening is because everyone's distracted by their own stories and everything falls apart again. So yeah, I completely hear what you're saying. And I think that my suggestion, if you're enough of a masochist to watch this movie again, is embrace that randomness, and it may have a different flavor for you.
I think I'm definitely with Dan on this much more than with you, Alan, on the topic of the ending, because I think, you know, if I remember correctly, the guy gets the gun out of this instrument case that he was carrying around the entire time. Earlier on, I think Shelley Duvall kind of grabs his case. This is, what have you got in there? And he says, you know, don't open it, don't open it. So I think there is a red thread there throughout the film. And I do think that, yeah, that's just his version of trying to become a star. Some people, basically, they manage to become a star 5 minutes later. There's the next act might be someone breaking down mentally because she's breaking down in front of everyone. 5 minutes later, the act is someone shooting the star. 5 minutes later, the act is Keith Carradine singing a song. There's a kind of flattening of American culture that we're seeing in this, that's all of it is somehow equal. You know, you just press the forward button and YouTube or TikTok or whatever plays the next clip. Mm-hmm. And it's all about what comes next. And the shooting, I think, is definitely kind of a quintessential 70s American thing, but sadly probably not just 70s America. So I do think that this ending makes more sense to me, but I also agree, you know, it's not about the Kennedy assassination. It's just about what's the next act and can I be a star?
Yep, exactly. And I think that's what's one of the saddest things in the movie, and what really encapsulates what a lot of what the movie is about, is Shelley Duvall's relationship to her uncle, because like something really painful and important has happened in the movie. And this guy is like really reaching out to get some help to weather it from his niece. And she is completely absent. It's like, that's not to do with my story. I don't care. Like, when there's something like what she is looking for, the connection she's looking for is literally right. It is available and asking to connect in a real and powerful way. And she's just distracted into nothingness. And again, that's a story that goes nowhere. Like, it just ends in more loneliness. So thanks a lot, guys. This really made my week. No, it's amazing to revisit these movies and to see them in a context like that.
I mean, there was a sort of season I watched Altman, and it was, I think, a really positive thing to do, is to sort of binge on Altman and to sort of take a lot of his films and to see them. I think it's interesting that the three films we have are all early Altman, and I think that does sort of raise, what do we think happened after the 70s? And I do think, actually, which came from binge watching them, and it's sort of quite a superficial level, but I think there's a lot to it, that he is working with amazing talent in the 70s that makes these films look incredible. They really have qualities that on the big screen, you know, are breathtaking at moments. There's moments where you think this is absolutely beautiful and I'm really engrossed. The Player looks to me like a TV.
Agreed, completely.
And I think there's an element to which he doesn't have the talent surrounding him. And whether he's not that interested in the technical side, he doesn't realize that it's as good, or he realizes, but he's not going to get the money to get the same people, or he's not going to have the time to do it in the same way. But I do think maybe part of it is just his films are harder to love because suddenly they're not as cinematically engaging as they were in the 70s.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like, if I'm being super charitable towards him, then maybe what he's saying with The Player, maybe that's the idea. like Altman came from TV. He shot, you know, mm-hmm. up until he's like 40 years old, he's shooting TV. And then he breaks out with MASH, right? So he knows the difference between Vilma Zsigmond and Bonanza. Like, he knows exactly what that means. And so it's possible with Shortcuts and with The Player that he is using this as yet another level of statement to nail it down. But, like, I get The Player. Like, I've never been able to get anything more out of The Player than I do in the first 2 minutes. Like, it's the movie's over. By the end of the long shot, I'm like, yep, I gotcha.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is just, like, riding it into the earth. And it's because, like, he no longer, I think what you're saying about Nashville is, like, even these despicable people in Nashville, he cares for them. Like, he treats them as humans. He's like, these guys are messed up. Like, it's really sad how messed up they are. But they are people at the root of it all. But in The Player, it's, you might as well be watching toasters. Doesn't make any difference. Like, no, I don't care about anyone. I don't even care about the people that I think I'm supposed to care about, because I feel it's all like a mechanism. And so that the style and the attack on it, on virtually everything is incredibly grating to me. And like I said, at the beginning of the conversation, like, that was my first, I was aware of Altman experience, and there's still something to it. Like, the barbs are still there enough that I didn't set myself in an anti-Altman camp from it. I was just like, I didn't like that. But there's something about the thing I didn't like that I liked. And as I went into the past, I found out what that was. But the only time that he returns to grace for me really is Gosford Park. That is something where he's like, it's removed enough from America that the gentleness comes back and the empathy comes back. And the sort of like the elegance, the small scale elegance of a murder mystery idea brings us back to like why The Long Goodbye works. It's like, The Long Goodbye uses this framework of Philip Marlowe's story to get us into a different place. And I feel like Gosford Park, that's not nearly that good. Like, at least it's in the right zone now. It's remembering there, this is a movie about the people we were watching as opposed to the mechanism of how we did it.
I mean, I guess the thing that really informed my notion that the visuals helped so much, that how amazing this looks and how he seemed to have had a sort of real control in terms of atmosphere, in terms of the sort of ambient, the way the music and noise was used in the film, is Three Women. Because the one thing I felt with that, if he made that 15 years later, 10 years later, it would be a terrible self-indulgent film.
Agreed.
There is something in the film about the quality that it's made, the quality of the visual, the quality of the acting. I think the way it's shot, the way it has this sort of, I mean, definitely you can tell it's an influence on Mulholland Drive, the way that he sort of creates atmospherics.
Yep.
He does it in that. He's not creating atmospherics in any of his films, I feel, by the mid-80s afterwards. It just doesn't seem to be in his arsenal anymore to do it. And it's sort of, Three Women is almost that in its purest form. It's not very Altman because he's just doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. I was surprised how much I liked it, given that it is an incredibly self-indulgent film. But it, in sort of the binge, if you're watching the later Altmans and then thinking, God, if the later Altman made this film, it would be an appalling film.
Without it, it'd be unwatchable. Yeah, completely.
Like, it would reawaken angry me going, who does this genius think he is with this indulgent nonsense? And so that sort of got me thinking about how when you watch the later ones, even when, I mean, The Player, it's more TV movie than the other, but none of them replicate that feeling where suddenly you're surprised by the beauty of it or how it visually feels. It is at best, it's almost like, you know, the British period drama. They can make them look good enough. There'll always be a level of visual competence. There'll be always a level of sort of, it's visually, it's got the detail, but it doesn't have something sort of poetic, or it doesn't have something visually really striking. And his 70s work has, I think, that shot through so much of it. And it's such a shame, I think, that sort of seems to sort of leave his, if you binge it, you sort of see it sort of drifting away, and when it's gone, it never comes back.
Do you think that is an aspect of filmmaking in general of the time? Because there's good looking movies through the 80s and 90s, but for me, it's like Hollywood settles, and actually this is happening again right now with the official Netflix look. Like, they have a very rigid set of standards for how to shoot, what to shoot, what kind of exposure brackets, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why all Netflix movies look the same. And I think the 80s, like, there are a couple of standout cinematographers, you know, working with Spielberg and stuff like that. But even then, like, I don't think they're doing their greatest work. Like Alan Davio kind of falls off the plate after a while. You know, Vilma Zsigmond, you know, like his work becomes a little bit less interesting when he hits that period. And most everybody is sort of hitting a studio style, especially towards the late 80s and early 90s, that just becomes really uniform. Like Shortcuts in particular, you know, looks like any legal thriller. You can compare the LA legal thriller looks exactly the same, but it's like long lens, close up, blah, 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 sweaty. You know, it's just like it's indistinguishable. And I feel like there is something about the dominance of the studio system at that time that may have finally broken him. Like it's certainly the topic he takes on in The Player. And like he makes a movie that is the product of the thing he's criticizing. Like it's just ugly and flat. And it's just like, I feel that with a lot of Spielberg's work bags out in that same time period. Scorsese has like wanders around for a while. Like everybody really has a tough time like trying to hit that. And like this happens to a lot of like with Netflix, you have a lot of, you know, good high end mid tier filmmakers, you know, like, oh, what's his name? Gilroy, who did Nightcrawler and stuff like that. And like he makes a movie for Netflix and you're like, where'd it go, dude? Like what happened? And it's that same like bloodlessness. And I really feel like there's a, it saps that spirituality right out when you start dealing with giant studio organization like that. Like no wonder why he had all that Altman had to say was like, well, here's my nod to Touch of Evil. Good night, everybody. You know? Like that's what happened to him.
I mean, are there any of the sort of later films that anyone sort of feels the sort of maybe is worthy of a little bit of a comment?
I mean, I have to say I'm kind of fond of A Prairie Home Companion, which I think it was his last film, 2006. It's surprisingly lovely and warm-hearted, but I have to say also now having seen those three films from the 70s, where he has the emotional warmth, but he also has teeth. And The Prairie Home Companion feels very much, if it wasn't the last film he'd done before he died, I might think, ah, well, it's okay, it's nice. And of course, because it's his last film, it takes on a certain significance. You know, you think it's obviously, you know, Altman feels death coming closer and it's there thematically. But I think you also then give it more weight than it would have if he'd done another two, three films. It's a sweet film. It's a nice film. I wouldn't definitely not tell anyone not to watch it. But I'd have to say that now I would definitely go back to those 70s films that have some of the same qualities, but more.
I agree. I think that Prairie Home Companion is like, what I find interesting about that movie, I completely agree with you. Like, it's a bordering on sentimental work for him. The thing that I found compelling about it is that, as you said, like, you can feel death starting to creep up on him. It's a very frightened movie. I think under the surface, it's not just like an awareness of mortality. It's like, it's a really jittery, I'm glad there's a sentimentality to it because like it's covering something that he is profoundly uncertain on. And like when I remember seeing the theater and I came out of there, like I feel kind of, that was a sweet movie, but I don't feel good right now. I came out of it. I don't think I came out of it with quite the feeling he meant me to. And that instability was really sort of upsetting. And I don't think that's intentional. I think that he knew he was at the end of the road and it started to infuse everything he was doing. So it made it maximize sentimentality, which comes off a little false. And that revealed the fact that he's got nothing. Like he's staring down the nihilistic barrel that he has created for himself through the slide of all of his films. And you can see that he's not prepared for it.
I mean, the only one I'd sort of bring up, which you've mentioned before, is obviously I could talk for about 90 minutes on Popeye, because I think that as a journey back to my younger self, seeing it in the cinema, there's something very, very sort of odd and strange about this big budget fiasco and that somehow he was involved in that. I think there's almost going to be an interesting book to read about it.
I mean, that movie, definitely, there's some really grand, beautiful swaths of that movie. It's such a strange, it's such a bad idea to have made it, and such a weird sort of, it's like, what if we got a bunch of actors, put them in some random island out in the middle of the South Pacific and gave them money to buy sets and or drugs? What would happen? and you come up with this like absolute acid trip version of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It's like, yeah, this like, oh, it's a community building film about like, at the same time, you're like, and it's a musical where the songs sort of stop halfway through and we're out of money. So he's going to fight a puppet octopus. And I was just like, what?
Which we never show. I mean, the oddest thing is, again, rewatching it as an adult is, you know, I've gone to sort of classic film nights and they will show like a cartoon or two before the film. So I finally saw the original Popeye. You see the stuff that kind of made the character iconic, which, you know, didn't exist in the 80s. And Shelley Duvall is doing an amazing version of black and white cartoon Popeye. Whereas I think as a kid, it's like we had sort of like a very sort of, there was a 70s cartoon that was just churning out very dull cartoon. But then you watch this manic performance and it's only coming from seeing the really, like the early Popeyes are crazy.
No, it's insane.
They're visually all over the place. And she is that. Like there's moments where she loses it and she's running around and it looks like you're seeing it in the cartoon. I mean, the only problem is that she has bones in her arms, so she can't quite wave them. Yeah, she can't quite do the really panicky wavy thing. Yeah, and I don't think she was method enough really to get them removed.
Exactly.
Just
for
this film.
Not quite there.
But there's so much. So someone thought it's a really good idea to get her to really work on this performance that replicates something from these cartoons. Because kids will love that.
Yeah, like I think you're right, because the old, like, I was very into animation when I was young, and I really love the old Popeye movies because they make no sense. Mm. They're kind of horrifying and you shouldn't show them to children. That's why I thought they were wonderful. And I was going to bring up video games anyway, but there's a video game out called Cuphead which matches that style virtually flawlessly. And it's the first piece of art that I've seen since Popeye that understood the incredibly frightening value that Shelley Duvall clearly understood. Like, she is just like, yes, this is the target. And I also want to throw in, I just did for my TikTok, I just did a thing on The Shining. And almost the entire thing is about how incredible I think Shelley Duvall is. And that her work in all of these, because, I mean, she shows up in all these movies in one way or another. She's one of my favorite parts of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Like, her little through line, like, carries the emotional validation of the film. Like, her journey is so sort of wonderful and contrary to the way you think it's going to go. Because, like, she shows up and she's basically, like, in this arranged marriage situation. And it's tragic. And then the guy dies. And then she's sort of trapped into prostitution. And you go, like, if you describe that, you're going to be like, oh, that's going to be a drag of a story. It's going to be really, really sad. And it's kind of not. Like, she finds a community to be a part of and finds happiness and love in it. And I'm just like, that's not what you do with that story ever. But Duvall carries it off beautifully and Altman supports the whole way. You know, and same with the antithesis of that is her in Nashville, where she is, if anyone's a villain in that story, it's her. Like, she is everything that people are doing wrong, like with barely a human being there. She's just mindless self-centeredness. Like, there's Jeff Goldblum, who's having a good time. He's just experiencing the whole thing. He's just as weird as she is. But she's the one who can't experience any moment of her life because the better thing is on the other side of the fence. And so I'm glad you brought that up, because, like, I love Shelley Duvall, and I think it's tragic that she just sort of disappeared off the scene. And she is an absolutely epic actor of the 70s and should be as remembered as Jack Nicholson is.
I would absolutely echo that. And I think I've sort of said before that the stories of bullying on the set of The Shining, it's like, you didn't need to bully Shelley Duvall to get a great performance. She would have done that, I think.
That's... Yeah, like, she's, I think, I mean, I definitely think that Kubrick was probably incredibly hard to work with. And there's plenty of stories of that. But she actually gave an interview to the Hollywood Reporter like a year or two ago, where she's like, a lot of people make that up into the story. Like, I'm some, you know, like, I had no control over what I was doing. And, like, and she basically said, like, I'm an actor. The reason why you think I'm brutalized on screen is because I'm a really good actor.
But I mean, I think this is, you know, laying the groundwork for a Shelley Duvall podcast, because
absolutely.
I would absolutely be in for that.
100%.
I absolutely 100%. Agree with you. I think she's amazingly underrated.
Yeah, she's a pure joy. She's a pure joy. And Popeye is like, that's the alternate way to open up this podcast is, what is your first Shelley Duvall experience? And it is Popeye. Like, I was singing Olive Oil songs before I even knew I liked movies. It's just insane. He needs me, 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 he needs me. Yeah, absolutely backwards and forwards in my brain.
No, definitely. I know, the Shelley Duvall podcast coming at the summer of underrated actors sometime soon, maybe.
100%.
But no, that was a really sort of great chat. And I think we've covered a lot about Robert Altman and like I said, as coming from someone who had a lot of baggage about Altman, I think it's really good to sort of come and discuss him and to some extent celebrate what was really great about the film. So I think we'll sort of leave it there and join us next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture.